Thank you for that introduction. My name is Hallie, and I'm a graduate student at Auburn University, Department of Crop Soil Environmental Science. And today I'm going to be talking about effect of suspended sediments on phosphorus transport and bioretention cells. So water quality is a huge concern here in Florida, especially in other parts of the country as well. But the good news is more and more communities are moving towards utilizing stormwater management practices in order to maintain a high level of water quality as well as maintain surface water bodies. So low impact development, green infrastructure are just several tools in order to reach those high goals of maintaining water quality and preserving surface water bodies. So I'm going to be talking about a practice today called a bioretention cell, and it's essentially a landscape depression that captures and stores stormwater runoff, and it removes pollutants from stormwater by several processes such as adsorption, filtration, biological decomposition, volatilization, etc. The photo on the left is just kind of a illustrated cross section that demonstrates what's going on beneath the surface. But the photo on the right is where you would most likely find a bioretention cell. So this is in a parking lot, and it's designed to receive the stormwater runoff from that parking lot. So we wanted to specifically look at the media of a bioretention cell because it is what is doing all of the work, essentially. So in the cross-section photo, you can see there's different layers, and the design of a bioretention cell really depends on your location. It's very location dependent, but we wanted to look at what happens in the long term. So when a bioretention cell is installed, how is it going to perform several years after it's been in place? Specifically, what happens after years of deposition of solids from stormwater? And we wanted to look at how that affects pollutant transport. So our question became, how does clogging of bioretention cell media by fine sediments affect phosphorus mobility and retention? So we wanted to do a lab study looking at this. And the first question was, do we use a column or do we go away from the column? Because one of the main drawbacks of column study is that you're only able to see water flow, pollutant transport happening in one dimension. So we decided to use a flow cell because you're able to really see what's happening in many dimensions, and water flow is in fact multidimensional, so we're able to kind of capture what's happening going in all directions. So there were several steps to this research, and the first step that we had to figure out was, okay, at what point is the media, at what point are we going to say that the media is clogged? So we used a media mix of 85% sand, 10% fines, and 5% pine bark mulch. And we used, our suspended sediment was ground silica. So we pumped in ground silica and water. We had an inflow tube coming in from the top right-hand corner, and then we have outflow tubes that you can't see, but they're at the bottom. And essentially, what we did was we pumped in that mixture, and our hypothesis was that the solids were going to build up right underneath the inflow tube. And then after pumping more and more, it's going to kind of radiate outwards onto the surface. And as you can see, the water ponding height gets higher because your surface area is getting covered up and media infiltration is going to get less and less. So during these simulations, we were conducting hydraulic conductivity testing and measurements and infiltration measurements as well. What we found was that at approximately 1 gram of ground silica per square centimeter of media surface was where we saw that decline of hydraulic conductivity. And we used that as our, essentially our clogged condition. So what we were able to do with that data was do some maintenance predictions on some hypothetical bioretention cells. So we had a bioretention cell of 20 square meters located in Auburn, Alabama. Average annual rainfall is about 1,500 millimeters, and we used some total suspended solid stormwater data from the National Urban Runoff Program, and we collected, or We used some numbers from three different land uses, residential, mixed, and commercial, and we were able to calculate total stormwater. So we had our 20 square meter bioretention cell, and we had two different conditions. We had a bioretention cell that was designed to receive, was sized at 5% of the total impervious surface area, and one that was designed at 10% of the total impervious surface area. So what that means is if you have a bioretention cell that's sized at 5% of your impervious surface area and 10% of your impervious surface area, that means that the 5% is going to drain 5% of the total rainfall that's received in that impervious surface area, and the 10% will drain 90% of the total impervious surface area that's generated from that area. So what we found was for both cases, the residential land use required the most amount of maintenance. And what I mean by maintenance, it differs where you are, but it could be removal of the top surface layer or complete removal of the media because it's been inundated with solids or whatnot. But for both cases, residential needed the most amount of maintenance, and mixed and commercial were it wasn't slightly as short of a time period for it to need maintenance. And the 5% required maintenance more often, but simply because it was receiving a higher amount of stormwater. But the fact that we were able to use our lab data and make these predictions was very interesting for us to do from that data that we collected. So the next step that we did was conducted some phosphorus flow trials. So as you can see, we have a thick layer of silica, and this is representative of our condition of 1 gram of ground silica per square centimeter of media, and that's what it looks like. So our synthetic stormwater contained 3.7 milligrams per liter of we used super triple phosphate. We also added in an iron oxide. We added in very hydrite just to mimic what is normally found in an urbanized watershed where phosphorus is normally bound to another particle. So we just chose iron oxide for that reason. So we had the same, there we go. So we have our inflow tube, just imagine that it's there, top right-hand corner, and then we also have the inflow tubes at the bottom. And the very cool thing about this flow cell is that this side is detachable. So after we pumped through the volume of stormwater that was necessary, we were able to place the cell on its side and remove the top, and we're able to take samples of the media without disturbing the distribution of phosphorus, without disturbing where things kind of came into place after the flush was done. So that was the very cool aspect about this flow cell. And this was the phosphorus distribution that we found in milligrams, and the top row is silica and the bottom four rows are the media. And we had anticipated that the phosphorus would be highest at the surface because it's not very mobile, it doesn't move very fast. But what we found was that we actually found some of the lowest levels of phosphorus in the surface. We also found one of the highest, or the highest level within this trial, the first layer of the media, which kind of correlates to what we had initially anticipated. But we also found a pretty high level at the bottom, and that raised a couple more questions. Is this just an anomaly in the background phosphorus, and was it just high in this area for whatever reason, or was there something going on with the flow? So was preferential flow occurring? So we conducted some preferential flow trials, and this is the same distribution as we had on the previous slide. And we flushed blue dye through the cell after we had done the synthetic stormwater flush, and we recorded it with a time-lapse camera just to see where is flow occurring, what do the flow patterns look like. And I have a couple screenshots of that video. And as you can see, I'll do this with the mouse. We're getting kind of faster flow through this area of the media, and that actually kind of correlates to that area of the media. So potentially preferential flow could be a reason why we were getting that high distribution in the bottom layer. So this brought up some more questions that even though these were replicated controlled trials with the same media packed the same way, to the same depth. We used four different media lifts when we were packing it, and it was replicated three times for each trial. We're still seeing preferential flow occurring in these situations. And if you think about what occurs in a field-scale bioretention cell, there's the level of precision that you can have in the lab compared to when it's being put actually into place. There's probably a lot more going on than we think. There's probably preferential flow, and there might be faster movement of pollutants through there that we don't even know about. So that just kind of brought up some more interesting correlations. And this is some more screenshots of different different time-lapse videos that we took, and we have the 1 gram per square centimeter condition. Then we also did a 0.5 gram per centimeter squared condition. But as you can see, preferential flow is occurring. It's occurring in different places, but we still have some faster movement of the dye in certain places, and sometimes it's going through, it's kind of making its way through the silica in this area. But so it's occurring, but it's occurring differently each time, but it's occurring even under these controlled conditions. So this is the time-lapse video for the initial. And as you can see, there's lots of ponding going on, but the movement through here is just faster through the rest of the media, which is very interesting for us. Some conclusions of what we found was that preferential flow exists in these lab conditions, and even though it was replicated and we were doing using the same conditions, it was still there. We also saw that phosphorus was more mobile than we had anticipated through the media. It did not just stay on the surface. And there are some maintenance considerations that say removal of surface layer is what you can do for maintenance purposes, but that might be insufficient. So there's lots of further research that can go from what we did. Looking at phosphorus delivery mechanisms into a bioretention cell, what is it bound to and how does that affect its transport? Also, what form is phosphorus in when it enters into a bioretention cell and how does that affect its retention and its transport? So lots of interesting things that we found through this study. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thanks.
In regards to your preferential flow, so I can think of a really good application to that in terms of a stormwater retention basin, probably wanting to have multiple inlets, right?
Yeah.
Agree with that, or?
Yeah. So when we were trying to figure out how to pump in the stormwater, we did decide on kind of using that one inflow tube, but I'm sure that we would see some pretty interesting results if we had multiple inflow tubes coming from the top. So it kind of depends on how you like what we use to do that. But that was kind of what we had decided to do. So it would be interesting to use something different. But
have you thought about just going to the field and taking a few soil cores, you know, at different spots?
Oh yeah, sure. We kind of just this research is just kind of taking off with the lab, but there'd be lots of interesting correlations to what you would find in the field. Definitely. Yeah.
So a huge part of how bioretention cells work is the vegetation within them. I mean, it totally changes nitrogen phosphorus cycling.
Definitely.
How does your results in this, you know, your little box, which is just totally physical and chemical, how do you expect that would be affected in the real world situation with the vegetation?
It would definitely be affected. I think that, I mean, it's definitely location dependent, but we've actually thought about doing some vegetation, trying to figure out some vegetation studies within the flow cell just to kind of be able to visualize what's going on. But I think that with the addition of vegetation is a huge factor of the pollutant removal. So in order, for this, we kind of, weren't really focusing on that, obviously, but I think that if you incorporated that into a further study, then that would be very interesting for phosphorus transport.
I think just to follow up on that, I mean, the one aspect of vegetation that I would expect to be really pronounced is the preferential
flow path.
So the effect you see would just be
well, yeah, well, in terms of porosity, but that doesn't take into account then the uptake and mobilization,
right,
which is huge also.
Yeah, I think it would be incredibly interesting if we incorporated the vegetation aspect within these studies, but for this we didn't, but it would be really interesting to see how it changes.
You know, Andrew Sharpley and others have written a lot about this legacy phosphorus effect, and typically you see that in agricultural watersheds, but this really points out that this can be a phenomenon that build up over time, that, you know, the movement through these preferential flow pathways. So, you know, even these bioretention cells can potentially be leaking phosphorus, you know, down into groundwater.
Yeah.
The picture of the cell that you showed, I mean, it's getting, you know, from all that impervious surface, do you think a lot of that phosphorus that's accumulating on that surface is atmospherically derived, you know, dust deposition?
It could be, it could be a big part of that. The reason why we used ground silica just because it's been used in stormwater studies before, but
right,
when we were thinking of, well, what is a suspended solid, I mean, it could be so many different things. So it could be, I mean, that plays a big part in it. But to keep it kind of, to keep with what's been done in stormwater research, we just decided to use ground silica. But I would say, yeah, definitely is a big part of it.
So this idea of preferential flow, you know, keeps being discussed. These bioretention cells are like 85% sand. We go to our coastal plains, you put phosphorus on, we're not worried about phosphorus runoff. You actually get leaching of phosphorus through the sands because there's no binding capacity for P. Your picture there with the water is a point. You go back to a soil science book from the 1920s where it shows how water spreads when it hits a clay or a sand. I don't know that that's preferential flow. That's just where the water is hitting, and you have your normal spread pattern as it's coming out. And if to me, preferential flow would be the water comes in one side, and somewhere along that continuum, away from exactly where it's dropping, that you get some pathways that might be from a root or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that, I don't see that as...
That, I mean, it could potentially not be, but we just thought it was interesting that it was moving faster through what we tried our best to control, and it was moving faster through one area. So, I mean, it could be due to many different things, but we kind of raised more questions with trying to answer our questions, so...
you mentioned in one of your first slides that it was 10% fine. Was that fine sort of composed of what specific?
So we used a stockpile of, actually a City of Auburn stockpile. It was a loamy sand, sandy loam. But that was our kind of fine component that we incorporated. So.
So based on these results, do you envision engineering some other type of?
Well, we actually, from this research, we have a soil chemist that was working with us, so we kind of want to go deeper and see, you know, on the molecular level and see what, like, look at more forms of phosphorus and look at what is, because when we incorporated the iron oxide into our stormwater, that kind of took it, that was kind of, I didn't really mention it because we added it in the hopes that it would bind, but it actually didn't bind, so then we were thinking, well, is the form of phosphorus different? So we actually kind of want to look at more, okay, what forms of phosphorus, using different forms of phosphorus, using different materials to bind with it, and see kind of if what we find with similar flow trials like this. So.
Thank you,
Allie. Thank you.
have to take a lot of questions. We do have some time for questions for our other speakers before we have here our final speakers. So are there any questions? Any questions for Odine, our first speaker, or Anna? Any speakers? Any questions for Anna? All right, Tanya. Any questions for Tanya? Any questions at all?
So I have just an announcement. There's been a number of good papers or presentations on lead here today. I just want to remind everybody of our lead symposium tomorrow afternoon at 1:30.
What room, Greg?
Right here.
In here. This is our room.
Yeah, hopefully you will.
And then after that is the business meeting in this room.
Exactly.
So no reason to leave and go anywhere else.
We have another
stay here tonight.
Yeah. No.
Today. We have another
right. And after this is the hot topic.
Kind of like a common question, but it's not related to the presentation, it's related to the kind of division, because I noticed all the presenters were females today, and I wanted to kind of know if that's where the division is moving, what's going on with in general,
You know, there's a really great poster that Karen Vaughn and Eric Rebick and others have that have to do with diversity in soils, so I know I'm going to go check that out. I think it's just the way things happen.
We're just lucky.
We're just lucky, and we're glad to have everybody, and we welcome everybody. I'm sure all of the other groups do, too. So, coincidentally, our luck. I got Greg. We're lucky. Well, if we don't have any questions for the other speakers, we'll hear from our final presenter.